plan the arrangement for the beginning of the month, and guess what that tradition, guess what that tradition is, and what he's modifying. I think one of the ways into it, Neil, will be in fact just that. What happens to this family situation and its environment? That is, if you can like configure to yourself this, that the thing that fundamentally in the fire, I think, in the very first place attracts him to that House of Atreus play is not so much the fact that in actual Greek historical terms, it's obviously a Dionysian drama for his particular social religious purposes, but that it is a relationship between fully human beings. In that case, placed in front of their house, you know, that visible house on the stage, as far as he's concerned, whether in fact it was the temple or not. Now, what one's got to do is say something like this. One's got to try and get to the position where the house and temple mean the same thing. Now, this sounds kind of odd, but it works all right. If you take the word, the idea of the temple to be the folk, the visible enclosed space which houses the essential energy through which the human race is continued. Is that what the temple is, isn't it? The idea of the temple, you see. It is a house, isn't it? I mean, in the Christian religion they talk about the house of God. You see what I'm trying to say? I mean, this is the way to get into it, isn't it? Is to get into everything that traditionally house temple means. This is what I'm trying to get at. This is where it's at. And it's the same with Strindberg, of course, and Ibsen. We're all house people. And the whole of the 19th century is full of house dramas, house plays, and house novels. I think all Henry James. But I think the important thing is to watch the ways in which the better attitude, for our purposes particularly in drama, particularly when the guy is updating psychologically, you know, Greek stuff, is to think of the fact that the temple and house are like interchangeable symbolic spaces. You see, we're concerned with what is the meaning of the spatial area in which this action takes place? What is the scene? Why is that scene, you see? Again and again, the most powerful plays are in the other. The most interesting thing about the Iceman Comet, then, obviously, is that this is a kind of substitute house, you see? It's a kind of temple which has become a non-family area. You see what I mean? It's a very important thing, because the family action in Iceman comes from outside, isn't it?
You mean don't they?
No, I'm talking about the Iceman Comet now, just in case it was in your mind. You know, it's a bar, you see.
Yeah.
So, and like, you know, Hemingway again and again was fascinated by bars, the temples. You know, where sort of libations are taking place. And Hemingway doesn't have houses and homes very much in his books. You see what I mean? His temple tends to be the bar. I mean by that quite strictly, what is the space in which energy is delivered to you? Do you see the kind of thing I'm trying to get at? Do you see that? Mr. Kent, do you?
Yes.
Do you see some of it? Well, ask me some questions. What does she see?
Well, you're not going to limit spaces to... Well, obviously, there are a multitude of spaces, so-called, where you can receive energy, aren't there?
Yes, but they tend to be subsumed in this temple house idea, you know. I mean, just think of those huge Victorian houses, which were like the visible spatial continuity area, were they not, you know? It was handed on.
But don't necessarily have to be a house when you have a blasted heat or...
No, that is in fact something completely different. That's the earth. That's something else. You know, I mean, there's the earth. And there's the image of the earth, and there is the sky and the image of the sky. And then there is something else. There's what the human beings put on that, which, like, harnesses energy. Do you see what I mean? And the whole point of the heat in King Lear, I think, at least, is, yeah, it's a matter, I mean, Shakespeare's word is unhoused, you know, unhouseled.
But it's still some energy.
Yeah, and unaccommodated. Do you see, the whole point is that, and he stripped off his clothes. You know, at one point, he tried to get...
Yeah, I obviously it's totally different. I mean, the idea is totally different, but it's still the same. You know, it's an area in which
atmosphere
energy.
But, and the point is, he comes out of his house, you see, which is the palace, and onto that heath where he is standing bareheaded, and finally without his clothes, confronted with the energy in the cosmos, which is storm, blasted heat. You see, this is the function. I mean, it's from house, temple, palace. You see, that's all power area of enclosed energy, with a man who embodies it as a priest king. Out to where, what you were saying just now, all the things you were saying just now, the unaccommodated, you know, the palaces and so on. You see, I said it in the thing. Now, this is important, particularly. One of the interesting developments in 20th century drama is when the bar of novels, when the bar or the hotel becomes the plate, the scene. You know, again and again, the transitoriness of 20th century and modern life is focused in the fact that people come together in bars and in hotels, isn't it? In book after book, play after play, you know, or in a restaurant, do you see? In this way, this is not the palace, the hotel, or the blasted heat. You see what I'm trying to focus on?
When you're in the temple, it sort of isolates one way of thinking and puts it in a box, so that other ways of thinking can't get to it.
Yes.
Is that one of the things that's interested in or not? Something becoming so isolated that it eventually loses this
way. Yeah. Well,
I think that's what I meant by saying, you know, when you're talking about heat, it's
exactly
the same, you know,
yes.
separate.
I don't think it's... I think the romantic things start... I mean, that's right, technically, from, you know, late 18th century onwards. What happens is that then the temple does become nature, do you see, in that sense. But it's an aberration, it really is. I mean, it is not central, that idea of God's imminence in the landscape, in the history of Europe or the West. It is an absolute aberration. I mean, who goes to you probably saw this film on television where they're talking about Balinese. You see, there's a couple of months from the where they had a Balinese activity of dance and dance drama and so on. And again and again, the band sits in front of some steps with a door. And they play and play. And then at the moment, the door's flung open, and down, and then the figure stands there in some kind of pose like the Balinese dancers do, you know. And then moves down the steps. You see what I mean? And then goes back into that building. It's doors, steps, that sort of, that they're coming out and showing themselves. You know, like Oedipus does. It's not we're concerned with. I mean, in the Moon for the Misbegotten of O'Neill, that house is vital, isn't it? You know, the coming and going of the house. In Desire Under the Elms, the whole side of the house is split away, so that you see all the rooms at once. That is a really fantastic event in the whole of this, because you see, and you know, at one point, the two people are like in different rooms, and their love for each other is going through the wall, as it were, this whole energy in that way. And they pray, if you see it on the stage, it's visibly there. You see them pressing up against the wall, which is between them. Do you see it in this way? This is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the housing of energy in this temple house palace area. Do you see? I'm trying to get into this with you. And that. And to leap off from last week, when we're looking at Martin Moore becomes lit, you see that the sterility of that thing is really what happened there, isn't it? Because that's why I was talking about this, how it's a bourgeois play, because one of the ways to look at the morning becomes the distance, as it were, from morning becomes Electra to our play, Long Day's Journey, which again takes place in this room. You know, in the house, and it's that house feeling. She goes upstairs and she comes downstairs and so on. You see it enclosed. And the books in. He even gives you what the names of the books are in the bookshelves, you know, you see. It really is it's a cultural centre, isn't it, in this way, you see?
But yet she's always complaining that it isn't her house.
Right. Right. And Edmund is always thinking about like getting out and so on. But where do they? Where are they? And isn't the feeling always they never will get out?
No.
Do you see? Isn't it? This is the essence of the play, isn't it? They're not going to budge. They're not going to move. It's going to be like this. But what I think was one way of measuring that is to go a little bit before now. I know it's kind of glib games, but there is this thing in the history of drama called bourgeois tragedy. Now, what does that mean? It means the desire to write plays about the ennobling of human energy, about for people who are not already nobles or royals. Huh? You see? I mean, Arden of Feversham, you know, and what's that York play? Something with York, I can't remember. It's the same time with Arden of Feversham. And then right through, of course, to the function of the novel, you might say, is to take part in this, that you write your, so that your main characters are not nobles, or, you know, they're more Flanders, or Clarissa. Clarissa is the classic bourgeois tragedy, isn't it? You know? Because she's pulled through a bush backwards and sort of ends up deified, really, because that funeral scene is really a deification scene, isn't it? All white, you know, everybody's sobbing around. But then, again in the 19th century, the urge is to get the theatre going along these lines again. And then you get, of course, the major figure is Ibsen. Now, you have to think about this because, for instance, let's just think of a play like John Gabriel Borkman of Ibsen. The play opens where the hero, who is a banker who has been like involved in shady deals, has been upstairs in an upstairs room in this house for 16 years. You see, and there's that housing and energy for you. And in the bottom part lives his wife and his sister. You see, this two-part house thing starts. That is the setting. And the play ends with them getting out. And as soon as they get out of the house and they're exposed to natural energy, snow, mountains and so on, death. This is what happens when the bourgeois tragedy idea and the idea of romantic exposure to energy, which you find in the romantic poets, you see, to the unhoused, unenclosed area called the earth and the sky. And Ibsen again used it in Brand, you remember, the death of the heroes through an avalanche. And he comes out of his house and questions God in nature.
In the Wild Duck,
you see this kind of thing.
The death of the girl takes place in the house.
Yeah, right. But then the dream she has, remember, is of diving into that water and getting stuck at the bottom. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you see that? I think so that one, she dives inside the house, or that house. To the, that dream area is a very much a natural image thing. It turns towards the end of Ibsen's life. That he takes them outside, and when we get the Awakening, for instance, you know, little aisles, something like that. But the tension in Ibsen between the field and the house by the field is central in the work of Ibsen. And the sea is the place you can go off to, which is obviously in O'Neill at the end of the end. But it's that, if you like, think of the house and the field in Ibsen, the mountain with the avalanche, you see. And in Ibsen, O'Neill, the opportunity to go to sea and the house, you see, as the structure here. I think in The Moon for the Misbegotten, by the way, my memory is not too good on this one. As far as I remember, there's some stuff about, there's some nature stuff there, isn't there? About the farm and so on. My memory is not too good on that one. So we're concerned then of. In these plays, and in Strindberg, of course, too, with plays which are in the world from the 17th century onwards, in which the middle class, the non-noble people, people who have power, financially owning the land, are to be ennobled in traditional ways, you see. And finally, they're also to be laid off, according to O'Neill, in line not only with the royalty tragedies of Shakespeare, but the semi-deified royalty tragedies of the Greeks through Freud. Freud is intended to be some intended to be that the what is injected into the bourgeois, as you said to me, to blow them up to tragic proportions. Because if you say they have this Freudian structure in which they fit, it's the equivalent of necessity, which makes for tragedy. Do you see? I mean, if you're in a structure which says, okay, the oracle said it's going to be like this. And there's this pattern of inevitabilities, and you don't have God, which we were talking about last time. How do you get your bourgeois characters, your non-noble characters, and particularly for Americans, into a condition of transcendental nobility, which is in that bourgeois tragedy condition? Do you see what's happening? This is it. And I think, well enough to know what I have to say about this, and that is that I do feel very strongly that the sheer deathliness of not being able to get out again and again and again in O'Neill is about as far as you can go along those lines. You know, he really is the ultimate bourgeois man who's saying the best that I can show you is characters going round and round and round inside that sacred area called the house, the temple, the palace, the bar, and make it as lively as possible. But they're not going to get out. When they do get out, they will like somehow succumb. There's this dream, you know, these pipe dreams in Iceman of getting away, and they come back, you know? It's just non-revolutionary act of trying to find basic minimal stabilities, which is very powerful in his work. So I think if you think of the bourgeoisification of tragedy, and then think of O'Neill as the master of it, finally, I think you have clues what's going on in Long Day's Journey. Don't you feel that in Long Day's Journey that the basic mode is pathos, isn't it, here? Isn't it? And he's concerned with pity, a great deal. Man, one should lay it off with the old Aristotelian, but I mean, there's not much fear. You see, it's a play of pathos, isn't it? And it's really moving, I mean. I'm not sneering at that at all. I think it's a moving structure. Let me just remind you, as I read this thing, and I'm going to deliberately read it without dramatizing, because I make a fool of myself and ruin the text as well. I think that the passage to take would be Act 2, Scene 2, I think. I'm sorry about not having the text, but it's, you know the play, where you get the text. It's actually seems to. Can you go into the text quite a way? And it's the dialogue between Mary and Tyrone when they're on the stage alone. The stage direction is he stops in the doorway and sees his mother approaching from the hall and moves aside that they're coming. Her eyes look brighter and her manner is more detached. This change becomes more marked as the scene goes on. You see that? Now, then Jamie goes out, disappears to the front parlour. Now I think that what one wants to examine here is how O'Neill does this little few pages of dialogue I think the relationship between these two people to produce the pathos and to produce the degree of nobility that these people have is so exciting. Thanks very much. Oh,
thank you.
It's all right. So now, But Mary says, what's the matter with Jamie? Have you been nagging at him again? You shouldn't treat him with such contempt all the time. He's not to blame. If he'd been brought up in a real home, I'm sure he would have been different. Obviously, immediately there's this reflex going on. What sort of home is this? And then she comes to the windows at right, lightly. You're not much of a weather prophet, dear. See how hazy it's getting. I can hardly see the other shore. Tyrone's trying to speak naturally. Yes, I spoke too soon. We're in for another night of fog, I'm afraid. Oh, well, I won't mind it tonight. No, I don't imagine you will, Mary. And she gives him a look. I don't see Jamie going down to the hedge. Where did he go? He's going with Edmund, the doctor's. He went up to change his clothes. And then glad of an excuse to leave her. I'd better do the same, or I'll be late for my appointment at the club. He makes a move toward the front parlour doorway, but with a swift, impulsive movement, she reaches out and clasps his arm. Don't go yet, dear. I don't want to be alone. I mean, you have plenty of time. You know you boast you can dress in 1/10 the time it takes the boys. There's something I want to say. What is it? I've forgotten. I'm glad Jamie is going uptown. You didn't give any money, I hope. Tyrone, I did not. Mary, he only spent it on drink, and you know what a vile, poisonous tongue he has in his throat. Not that I would mind anything he said tonight, but he always managed to drive you into a rage, especially if you're drunk too, as you will be. Tyrone says, I won't. I never get drunk. And Mary then, oh, I'm sure you hold it well. You always have. It's hard for a stranger to tell, but after 35 years of marriage, Tyrone, I never missed a performance in my life. That's the proof. If I did get drunk, it's not you who should blame me. No man has ever had a better reason. Mary, reason? What reason? You always drink too much when you go to the club, don't you? Particularly when you meet McGuire. He sees to that. Don't think I'm finding fault, dear. You must do as you please. I won't mind. Tyrone, I know you won't. I've got to get dressed. And Mary reaches out again to touch him. There's all these points at which there is this touch between their bodies. Now, please wait a little while, dear. At least until one of the boys comes down. You'll all be leaving me so soon. Tyrone, it's you who are leaving us, Mary. Aye, what a silly... That's a silly thing to say, James. How could I leave? There's nowhere I could go. Who would I go to see? I have no friends. Tyrone, it's your own fault. There's surely one thing you can do this afternoon that would be good for you, Mary. Take a drive in the automobile. Get away from the house. Get a little sun and fresh air. I bought the automobile for you. You know I don't like the damn things. I'd rather walk any day or take a trolley. I had it here waiting for you when you came back from the sanatorium. I hoped it would give you pleasure and distract your mind. You used to ride in it every day, but you've hardly used it at all lately. I paid a lot of money I couldn't afford, and there's the chauffeur, and I have to board and lodge and pay high wages, whether he drives you or not. Waste, the same old waste that will land me in the poorhouse in my old age. What good did it do you? I might as well have thrown the money out of the window. And Mary says, yes, it was a waste of money, James. You shouldn't have bought a second-hand automobile. You were swindled again, as you always are, because you insist on second-hand bargains in everything. Tyrone, he's one of the best mates. Everyone says it's better than any of the new ones. Mary, it was another waste to hire Smythe, who was only a helper in the garage and never had been a chauffeur. Well, I realize his wages are less than the real chauffeurs, but he more than makes up for that, I'm sure, by the graft he gets in the garage on repair bills. Something is always wrong. Smythe sees to that, I'm afraid. And Tyrone said, I don't believe it. He may not be a fancy millionaire's flunky, but he's honest. You're as bad as Jamie, suspecting everyone. And then she said, you mustn't be offended, dear. I wasn't offended when you gave me the automobile. I knew you didn't mean to humiliate me. I knew that was the way you had to do everything. I was grateful and touched. I knew buying the car was a hard thing to do, for you to do. And it proves how much you loved me in your way, especially when you couldn't really believe it would do me any good. Tyrone, Mary, dear Mary, for the love of God, for my sake and the boy's sake, you know, won't you stop now? Meaning reference to the drugs, of course. And she pretends then that, in fact, that she doesn't know what's going on. Now, up to that point, at this point, notice the dialogue has been continually ways of suggesting the relationship between the tight relationship between these two people in the past is the point, isn't it? Continually, you see. That now it's got loose and it's habitual. And they're rehearsing things. And there's a steady kind of tenderness, they're not abusing each other. And all the time there's this talk about getting out of the house and through the car, through this basic technology of the, in America, at least, of the automobile. And there's this vision of out, do you see? All the way through. And a sense of them not wanting to humiliate each other, but they do. Of being in a sort of landlocked situation of circularity. And this feeling in the dialogue that they've gone through all this before, which is a sort of landlocked situation inside the house, do you see, psychologically. And of course we know about the drug situation by now in the play anyway. And she said, James, we've loved each other, we always will. Let's remember only that. Again, this remembering. And not try to understand what we cannot understand, or help things that cannot be helped. The things life has done to us we cannot excuse or explain. And there's that structure that I was talking about, a necessity. There's this area of necessity immediately here, of wanting very much to have an area of an ennobling necessity, the equivalent of the tradition of tragedy in the thing. And then she talks about trying to go for a drive and so on. Then the next piece, I think the important one, her manner becoming more and more remote. At the convent I had so many friends, girls whose families lived in lovely homes. I used to visit them and they visited me in my father's home. But naturally, after I married an actor, you know how actors were considered in those days, a lot of them gave me the cold shoulder. And then right after we were married, there was the scandal of that woman who had been your mistress suing you. And from then on, all my old friends either pitied me or cut me dead. I hated the ones who cut me, much less than the pitiers. And Tyron says, God's sake, don't dig up what's long forgotten. And if you're that far gone in the past already, when it's only the beginning of the afternoon, what will it be tonight? And then again, come to think of it, I do have to drive her uptown. And she has to go to this drugstore. Now, everybody knows why she has to go to the drugstore, is to get her stuff. Again, the sense that really the only way out of the house is to that shop. And the only way out of that house situation is through the drug which she's going after. So it locks it back, you see. It isn't really a journey anywhere. Is the point I'm making. And so all the time they're remembering the past and rehashing it. But there's a kind of relationship between them, which is very like the relationship between the captain and his wife in Strindberg's The Dance of Death. Do you know? It's neither love nor hate. It's a sort of remembering neutrality which like sways to one way or the other every now and then, but it's like habit. It's habit, memory, duration, endurance inside this area. As if their energies are landlocked, do you see, inside this house. It's just, it is a kind of pathetic sterility, but they're keeping going. And the nobility is them keeping going inside this necessity structure, do you see. It's a duration, it's an endurance inside the necessity and measured by the house. And the comings and goings, the changes in mood and the flickering of emotion when they go back inside themselves and come out again, the momentum of touching each other keeps changing the relationship within its central steadiness. And a very good moment, I think, in the play, and typical of the sort of thing only almost very well goes on. And Tyrone says to her scornfully, I hope you'll lay in a good stock ahead so we'll never have another night like the one when you screamed for it and ran out of the house in the night dress half crazy to try and throw yourself off the dock. And Mary, first of all, tries to ignore this. I had to get tooth powder and toilet soap and cold cream. And then she breaks down. James, you mustn't remember. You mustn't humiliate yourself. And then he's completely ashamed. I'm sorry, forgive me, Mary. And then, again, instead of like a scene, she goes off again. It doesn't matter. Nothing like that ever happened. You must have dreamed it. Then she goes back into the past again. And he says again, forget the past. And then she says, the past is the present, isn't it? It's the future too. We all try to lie out of that, but life won't let us. Then self-recriminations about the death of her child and remembering the babies. And then this. It's my fault. I should have insisted on staying with Eugene and not have let you persuade me to join you just because I loved you. Above all, I shouldn't have let you insist I have another baby to take Eugene's place because you thought that would make me forget his death. And you've experienced by then that children should have homes to be born in, if they are to be good children. And women need homes if they are to be good mothers. I was afraid all the time I carried Edmund. I knew something terrible would happen. I knew I proved by the way I'd left Eugene that I wasn't worthy to have another baby and that God would punish me if I did. I never should have borne Edmund. Then Tyrone is not interested in what might have been hubris and blasphemy at one time or another in this drama, but Mary, be careful with your talk. If he heard you, he might think you never wanted him. He's feeling bad enough already. And so on. That's just the Edmund. Now what I want to suggest, again, the home thing there and the children. This idea that, again, it's very much in Swinburne and very much in Ibsen. That, and very much in bourgeois tragedy, and it's there in Tennessee Williams, and it's certainly there in Arthur Miller, that that central bourgeois program, that the strength and energy of the community is in the family, has broken down. This is one of the reasons, I think, for O'Neill's power. Because he knew it, and the audience knew it. And the reason why the plays, one of the basic reasons why the plays work is, he's talking about something that, you know, Martin Engels were talking about in the 1840s, like in that famous book called The Holy Family and all the rest, and like there's other works on the family, which is still very much the point now, that may be, the implication in a lot of these plays is that maybe the family itself, you know, and all that that it means in the history of human, in the human culture in the West, let alone the drama, is coming to an end as a viable proposition. That there are alternatives. And that maybe the bourgeois idea of the house as the property symbol of energy diminishes the very energy that it was supposed to generate and propagate. Because it's a very strong implication, isn't it, in Money Becomes Electra and Fiend, don't you agree? It begins with itself, but somehow the institution called the family, which is like the generating center of society, of culture in the West, in the bourgeois West, inside that house, so that somehow the family is the priest of continuity, aren't they? And think of the stress on the family in the 19th and 20th century, right? But somehow, particularly I think in American society, very much so. That, you know, it's like the family that loves to loves together, sticks together, something. What is that?
Prays together.
Remember that? You know, that kind of thing goes very deep into American society. And I think that Irish Catholic backgrounds too have this very strongly, nearly as strongly as a following no Jewish one, according to the recent literature.
Is that why Tyrone seems to be one person in the Vale who still feels that things can get worse? I mean, he's always saying, I'm afraid of the poorhouse, and the fact that his sort of his main preoccupation outside his family is his property, and the fact that he's got a house, he's got property.
Yeah.
Things for him can still get worse, whereas the others are very
good. He's always had this dream, hasn't he, all the time, to play it, that he will have stability, and by that he means the family in that house.
Yeah.
And
but
it's
he's finished. Also got, I mean, he can also lose it totally and end up in the poorhouse.
Yes.
Which the others.
Which, you know, when you think, really, all it means is that I'm going to lose the image which society has provided. But poverty, of course, is sin in the Protestant era. And this is the overturns of what poverty means, and going to the poorhouse, being unethical. No, it isn't just like not having any money. Do you see, there's that threat to the whole way of life. I think that I was trying to get at the roots of power. In here's the husband and the wife talking about the children, talking about the home, talking about the car. You see? Talking about drugs. This is the structure of the boy in my life. As you know, I mean, everybody knows it, and it's an open secret that most middle class families in America and in this country take drugs of one kind or another. It's ludicrous, pretend they don't. And there's a representative family going on here. And although like it's slightly disguised, because it's supposed to be like a rather randy actor and his drug taking wife and so on. But it has a sort of bourgeois archetype about it, does it not? You see, the elements are the right elements, are they not? Imagine the audience for this on Broadway or in London or in television. Do you see? What sort of recognitions would be going on? What sort of chance does O'Neill give the audience to say it's just a play? And the answer is precious little, because the scene is too familiar, is it not? It is this, one of the functions of the bourgeois tragedy is to reconcile the bourgeois audience to what they take to be destiny. Right? You know, so you don't analyze it. I mean, Coronation Street, you know, that sickening, hateful life that those people live with their petty bickering and their meanness and their general, like, predatory activities is portrayed as human nature, isn't it? The state of things. One wouldn't say nasty, brutish and short, but the damn one really is. It's in short, that's the trouble. It's certainly nasty and brutish. But a great deal of bourgeois drama goes on the understanding that the family and its breakdown is also in the nature of things, and that it is your duty to strive to keep the family together under those circumstances, right? And that if it breaks down, at least you've tried. You know, this, the whole myth going on here. O'Neill is in the centre. The one thing he doesn't do is what, you know, this term psychodrama, I take it, you know. This is the kind of play you get the most monstrous case of it. I mean, there's a man called William Inge in America who wrote the title is called Dark at the Top of the Stairs. Well, that's psychodrama. A psychodrama was a phrase coined, I think, by Robert Warshaw, a young critic who died unfortunately. It means plays which are at the end tidied back into psychological solutions of a schematic kind for comfort. Saying, you know, using Freud as necessity, using psychological schemas as necessity, saying, okay, like, you know, it's human nature, and this is the structure of it, and there's nothing you can do, and there's no change possible. It's the gruesomeness of Arthur Miller, you know, where all he can do when the salesman commits suicide is have the mother come on and say, attention must be paid to this man. As far as I'm concerned, it's wickedness. you know, that's all you've got to say at that point. You might as well stop, as far as I'm concerned. Because attention doesn't need to be paid to that man, attention needs to be paid to that society. And the myth of, you know, boyishness and so on, that he died for. Huh? Sorry.
In these places, the more the family itself breaks down,
yeah,
the more they're sort of drawn to the thing you've symbolized to the family, which is
the house.
Which
right.
is sort of just like putting yourself in a tomb.
Well, which is exactly what happens at the end of When They Become Victory, remember, where they all get like each other. Because, you know, the makeup program we talked about last time, where they're all supposed to, you know, not mask, makeup. And then she finally goes in, pulls all the shadow down, goes in and stands all down curtain. Which is...
So isn't this faith then that makes them stick to the thing?
I think it's a... I think that O'Neill doesn't say. I mean, the implication is it not, you see? It continually is. Mary has a primitive belief in God. She said, God would punish me, do you see? But she said, no, about. But what one looks for in answering your question is, what is it that O'Neill feels is necessity? What does he feel is the program which won't enable things to change so that you can ennoble these people because they're caught in things that they are? Because tragedy is, after all, like can only be composed if you really think there's something called necessity, which is not going to change, doesn't it? Otherwise you're going to have tragedy. You just have like a series of moral disasters, which could be different. The point is that tragedy implies everywhere, doesn't it, that things can't be different, you see. So that, and I think, as I say, I think it's the greatness of O'Neill, and I mean greatness, I think that one must commit oneself to a play like this, is the way he shows you these characters enduring, making a life within a program that they're convinced couldn't possibly be different, do you see? So hang on to the car, the house, the journey to get the drug, you see, and so on, the dream of getting out, the dream of property. You don't say something, Mr. Kerr, I think.
No.
Got this whole sense off you. But notice I've read that passage after you, that the comings and goings, this sense of life, I mean by that, the sense of vitality, the sense of continuous flickering of relationships, you know. It isn't like a steady ball. It is, in fact, there's endless subtlety inside that situation, you see. It comes and goes. The levels of relationship change.
But surely isn't that the aspect, you know, the fact that they are occasionally affectionate towards each other, is one thing that is trapping them. If they were living in a continuous, like, toothache, they'd get out of it much more quickly.
Right. It's the fact that they want to reconcile each other to each other and to the situation, isn't it? It is a great drama of pathos and reconciliation, isn't it, this play?
But that's really what's destroying them, not so much it.
And lifespan, don't you think? I mean, because that bar at the bottom of the harbour is really an area of reconciliation, isn't it? You know, continually, isn't it? The aim is to be reconciled.
Yes.
And Hickey is the intruder.
But in the long day's journey, the only reason you get for the two sons being back is make another one.
Yeah.
They don't want to work.
Except that you know very well that Edmund's dreams, you know, his sea dreams, are things that are not fulfilling for a man. I mean, they're still boys, and in that passage, he refers to them as the boys. You know how people, I'm sure you must have heard this in your own experience, that there are certain parents who never think of their children as them. They always refer to them as the boys in that way. And not in an endearing sense, but really in a deliberately immaturing sense, you know, in that particular way. I think that's the way one handles that bit, Mr. Kiernan, I think. You know, that one, it's why are those boys there? Why are they still fighting like they do, you know? And it really is that the family situation has not allowed them to grow up. Because if you're still in a family, if you're still in the original family situation you were born into and haven't left it, you won't. Because you can't, you're still a boy in that situation. This is like, you know, it's like as if it were the primal horde situation in Freud hadn't worked. You know, like, you know, the story of the primal horde situation in Freud is that the second generation of sons attack and kill the father to get the harem. Or worse than effect. Which includes the mother, by the way, in Freud's version of this. Now, in this case, it's as if it really is sterile, because there's no second generation. If you see what I mean, taking over. It's just repeating, isn't it? And I think one of the major things in O'Neill is, in this, and remember we were talking about this last time, this is a disaster era. This play is, what, 40? Do you remember? Not the date, it's 46, is
it?
40,
December 20th.
40.
Right.
41,
July the
22nd. Okay. I think. Never mind. Anyway, we've got the 40s. what I'm saying, like, where's the first play? It was like 30. He wrote over that period of 20s, 29, was it, to 31, wasn't it? The morning becomes electric, I can't remember. I mean, you know, the crash period, the depression period. So. Here we've got the 40s with the incipient war and so on. And I'm not saying that O'Neill is deliberately using that one. I'm talking about the fact that this interwar period is a period of economic, psychological, and political crisis, if ever, isn't it? You know, I mean, the whole backlog of inheritance from the 19th century of authoritarian structures in politics, in economics, in religion, in the psychology, changes and stuff, is coming to a head in terms of crises, of continual crises, you see, in a particular way. So that the family is in an embattled condition, isn't it, at this time, do you see? One feels that O'Neill here is like all great artists, comes at the point where his own personal condition and the condition of his time meet, you know, in that way. And the power of his work, again and again, is that he's got that major theme, which is what happens to the family under pressure from the breakdown of certainties that could be assumed in the 19th century. To do with, like, the value of property, the hierarchical structure of father on top and then mum and then the kids, you know, down in this pyramid, this Victorian pyramid and family. Do you see? That kind of thing. What happens here to the situation? What do they cling to? Don't you agree that one somehow sees in one's memory O'Neill's characters clinging an awful lot? They sort of hang on like grim death to the remnants of what seems to them to give them power and energy, don't you think? And it's just, I have to ask you a question, where do these characters, you were talking about just now, where do these characters get their energy to carry on from? But it's not from social change, is it?
Just from self-realization.
Yeah.
They seem to be able to carry on when they face the truth about themselves.
Yeah.
But just in a self-realizing sort of way, kind of constrict.
And it's exactly like Freudian, isn't it? Because, like, the Freudian psychological gambit is, I'll tell you how you are and show you how you are, and then you've got to live. But all the stuff that made you how you are, you don't care down about it, but you can do nothing about it. So you can, like, hunt for origins, but then they're dumped at you, and then what do you do? You know, and the answer is, you, like William Faulkner, and his unpleasantness says, you endure. You know, the great Faulknerian program of bourgeois endurance, you know, and if you would want to turn around and say, I don't want to endure under those conditions, you leave me alone. You're either called a rebel or revolutionary, or like, you're just unpleasant and like rocking the boat, or all these phrases. I think you're right. I think you're right. I think too, the sense that, don't you think too, a sense that that despair generates energy.
Yeah.
Don't you think that too?
That's why you get the feeling of place it's going to carry on afterwards, because the last scene is just.
Right.
It is despair.
It comes into fire, isn't it, that we're doing?
Yeah. But once the certainties crumble and you're left to fend for yourself within a program which says live, says the family is important, says children should honour their parents, says the parents must look after their children, you know, the whole bit. Clearly, vitality and energy will come from just keeping that going in that sense. I think this is a power in O'Neill. I think it came out in the film marvellously, didn't you? This whole sense of, I think they made a mistake going to the garden in the film, by the way, for the reasons I'm suggesting. They should never have done it, because it senses freedom. I mean, look at that here, the power of the fact that they look through the window and they see fog, or the fog is coming on, do you see?
But it's foggy in the garden in the film.
But looking through a window, you must have been something else, isn't it? They're going out into this thing. I think that was a strategic mistake. The fog, by the way, in the mist is functional, isn't it? Again and again in O'Neill. In here particularly. The sense that what is the function of the fog in the play? Is it not to make you feel that they are like embattled and isolated, yes, and like sort of enclosed. It's like the function of the fog in Wuthering Heights, isn't it? The mist in Wuthering Heights, you know, to make the feel that there is like the houses are enclosed, the human beings are enclosed. That way, don't you think? That particular way.
It's like the prevailing atmosphere in Provincetown at the time where he produced so many of these.
Right. But you remember the famous story, I think it's in the Gelbs, that when they first produced some of the early sea plays, they didn't have to like get the fog going because the fog came up through the floorboards. So it just killed them.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
that sort of built in. By the way, I remember, you know, John Whiting, he's a student of mine who's doing the course at the Institute, and a friend, I'm missing. You don't mind if you're not sure, right?
get from the town.
His theater in Provincetown was on the wharf.
Yeah.
You know, right out on the water,
right.
And you did get this sort
Got the thing coming out. Okay, I think this is the kind of thing. I've made some very quick notes here. Let me just remember. Yes, I think I want you to write if you can to see then only or in this life, you know, in this tradition, and also to see it in terms of the not in terms of the bourgeois tragedy and what that means, but also in terms of from the stress I think between the wars when everything is crumbling on the family. You know, it's always the same, isn't it? The family is to take the burden in that way. Then what happens? So you've got this very ethical drama then of sex and the house temple and a continuity and stability. It's as if somehow all the trappings, all the elements of traditional theatre are there without the support of society. You know, there's no social support for these people, is there, you feel? You know what I mean? It isn't as though, there's no, it's a terrible thing that they're like alive in an era which is dead. But would you agree with me when I say this? I get the strong implication of the play that there is still, though, in O'Neill, a justification going on for Edmund's weaknesses from the family, isn't there? Again and again, we have to take it that Edmund is weak because the family is like this.
Yeah, but there's also, and when Mary is a drug addict, you get that.
Yes. So it's even more like reflexive, you see what I mean, isn't it? Again and again, like, why is the family like the family? Because it's the family. Mm-hmm. And why are the people like this weak? Because the family's weak. Well, who's part of the family? They are. It's the pathos of endurance within a structure where there doesn't seem to be any kind of energizing from outside the family, we see in that particular way, I think. So, I think that's the kind of thing. There's a phrase I got from a letter that O'Neill once wrote. The transfiguring nobility of tragedy. This is what he wanted continually. He really aimed to transfigure these people. Not just like sterile rats in a trap, but I mean into people who had dignity. And I think that I think in this play, particularly if you see it well acted on the stage, I think it needs that. The pathos finally moves over at crucial points into dignity. Do you know? Don't you think? I mean, these aren't just like flabby weaklings. You don't feel it.
Well, I don't think they're flabby weaklings.
Don't you think that they're keeping going, and they're not breaking down finally?
I think the idea of dignity is
always. Yeah, something else to that.
There's dignity
in
never missing
your
performance, whether it's on the
stage. Yes, exactly. It's just the kind of things I know. This is why I've left it to this stage to mention this, because I think that you say, if one says, especially I was to ask you, and quote that, this business about the transfiguring nobility of tragedy. Are these people transfigured into nobility? Then what do you say?
I think I'd say that you felt they had certain strength in spite of
their
strength.
What sort of strength is it, you think?
Well, this is just a strength for enduring, for carrying on in spite of this.
And what are you saying? Like self-knowledge seems to generate enough.
Of strength because the mother has to take refuge in drug.
Yeah.
And the father and the son are very powerful with whiskey.
Yeah.
Well, then,
it's very curious, isn't it? Just think what sort of energy injections that is, by the way. I mean, you see, it isn't from society, it isn't from friends, it isn't from other people, it is not from love, you see. It's from scotch and heroin.
And women for
Jim. who are on that level.
Yeah.
And it's very curious, because I think if one was to be, I think one would be very arrogant and very silly to maintain that this is an exceptional condition. I think the power of this play is that this is far more frequent, in fact, than people make out. You know? After all, without going to the kind of balmy extremely, there is a problem about alcoholism in bourgeois society. Both in this country and in America, isn't there? You know? And there's a drug problem. And what is the origin of it? Again and again it is
people are expected to behave as if family relationships could support everything in life, right? Again and again and again, that's where the breakdown point comes. Do you know that? Do you see what I'm saying? That's the thing. And I think that only is onto a very powerful area in this play, indeed. Do you not think?
Yes. I see it more personal than the family relationships are supporting everything. It's more the individual can't support everything.
Mm.
And he needs these psychological boosts of getting
by. Yeah. But it is the relationship between these four people, isn't it? Which is what's keeping them going. I mean, they didn't have each other. I mean, in that play, that why I created this passage was they keep moving away from each other and coming back and moving away and coming back. But finally, they'll come back.
So Evan was on his own and he tried to suicide.
Right. Yeah. So the death area, which they're warding off, is that, isn't it? The loneliness. And that's why I'm in that passage again. I think everything is in that passage, actually, if you look at it carefully. In the play, really, in essence, as it were. But the deathliness, the final end of vitality, does take place, as you point out, Mr. Kennedy, when a character becomes alone. This is what they're worried about.
There's ritual, compulsive repetition
mm-hmm.
of relationships. Just like, I'm going to mass every morning or something, it's doing the same thing over and over again.
Very much so. I think you feel that in the Iceman comic even more. I mean, taking your Scotch thing, I mean, the booze there, because it's a bar, isn't it? And what in the Iceman is the framework, is parties and bars.
But that's like sort of altered. Yeah.
Remember when I was talking about last year, with the lecture of Fitzgerald and Hemingway, we were talking a bit about this, do you remember? Like the sacral. What the sacral area is, the intake of energy in a special place. To see what I mean. Okay, it sounds kind of odd to say this, but in fact, it is important. I mean, the ritual of bar drinking is a very important kind of ritual. It's not the home, but you've got this intake of energy, which is equivalent to some kind of Dionysian energy intake. Let's face it, it just is. And if you think of Fitzgerald, Hemingway, and O'Neill as contemporaries, which they were, there's common ground here, isn't there? Something like they're saying, how do we energize ourselves in a time of catastrophe? Do you see? Huh?
Hemingway's clean, well-lighted plays.
Yes, yes.
Where it's really made into a temple.
Yes, except that it spiritually philosophizes, isn't it? And that we've given a Spanish word and so on.
Yeah, well, I think the whole thing is kind of funny. Right?
Yeah.
But how about the way they produce that delicate balance? Did you see that?
Yes.
The sort of crucifixion
of
the altar and everything.
Yeah. And the bar down the side and all the business of drinking.
Yeah.
And sat there. Yeah. That's very good that you mentioned that. But it's still going on.
Yeah.
And that Albee is, every one of Albee's major plays is like that. You think of like the American Dream, you know, which is the living room. You know. Unbelievable, and so on. But again, let's remind ourselves that the bad plays of this kind provide psychic solutions. You must, if you will, please bear in mind that idea of psychodrama. You know, because that is the psychodrama is a drama which places the whole of this in a context of solution from schematic psychology. There are a lot of plays like this. I don't think there's so many now, but in the 50s they had a real heyday on Broadway. And I think, if you read any play, it would have been interesting, you know what I mean? Quite a lot. I think that you see quite a lot of this in London theatre in a kind of submersible sort of way. Yeah. I think they have dignity just in terms of the way they do make keep going, the way they do in fact make a life for themselves.
Isn't that just desperation?
I think it's kind of dignity, but they don't give up. They don't give in, they don't yield, they don't go berserk. They finally do love each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Strindberg does it again. I mean, at least one comes back to that captain and his wife in The Dance of Death, you know, which is like nearly archetypal 20th century
psychological play, you know, that the dialogue is a flicker of going on living between the two of those, isn't it, endlessly? You know, they just are not. I mean, you know, the panic she feels when he looks so dead is important. Not relief at all. Relief afterwards when she thinks she is dead, but at the moment, like panic, because she's going to be on her own. It's like, okay, if you don't have the family and you've got loneliness, then what? Because there's a threat, isn't there, all the way through. Don't you think in any other play, all these plays, there is the panic, fear, loneliness. Don't you feel it? Right through the plays, everywhere.
Yeah, and they've kind of done away with the standard props, like
yeah.
Shakespeare or Siegfried, who are going to mess with people.
Yeah, right.
It's sort of dignified and
kind of
everyone
should
be on that.
I think so. I think so too. Yeah. Okay, well, obviously, like, you know, we had a different one. But I think there's a kind of. I don't want to philosophize it too much. I think when Hemingway does about the King of Almighty Place, it is, as John said, it is so funny. This is why I think Fitzgerald is so much better on it. That, I feel like Dick Diver really is on his own, isn't he? And I always find it very interesting, because the fact that he began as a psychologist and like gradually moves away from it, which seems to be it's in figures. But the I just think, is there, you obviously know, and you're much better than I do, you're near it, but is there a psychologist in any place? Did he ever bring one on? apart from Hickey. It was the kind of psychology, isn't it? Like, psychology. But that bar thing is important, I think. When you're looking at the Iceman, remember, it's like a temple area, and that they are drinking, which is like, you know, the sacrament. But it's at the bottom of the sea, and they're never going to get out.
It's worth noting that psychodrama has been taken over to designate the sort of therapeutic group improvisation as well,
yeah.
You know, acting out one's aggression spontaneously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I think that's the kind of thing one wants there. I think we might have looked finally before we just pack up that speech which you know at the end of Edmund's. Where they have been drinking, and they are drunk. And all those places in O'Neill's place where, in drink, they start to talk about the truth, interests me quite a bit. And O'Neill's quite a, he's not pretending about this, he said, with alcoholic talkativeness, like here, which is like saying, okay, this isn't the truth, this is revelation. There's something else. And he talks about like what it was like being free. Now, you probably know in our discussion or something, this hasn't come up. But the implication is that nobody is, isn't it, right? But the dream of freedom is interesting here. But just look what it is. He's lying on the bowsprit facing astern with the water foaming into spume under me, the masts with every sail white in the moonlight, towering high above me. I became drunk with the beauty and singing rhythm of it. And for a moment I lost myself, actually lost my life. I was set free. That's continuous in O'Neill, isn't it? The oblivion of one kind or another. This is what he's got, is a heroine, as it were, isn't it? And you remember there's a South Sea dream and a ship dream in Morning Becomes Electra, isn't there? For O'Neill's purposes, that all those experiences he had of being at sea and in movement across the surface of the earth and in contact with the sea, the moonlight and so on. Notice that beauty and rhythm. It's a different kind of rhythm than the family rhythm, isn't it? Which is like very slow and repetitive. This is an onward going linear rhythm. But that interests me very much, where losing your life is freedom. It might well be a parody of the Christian thing, you know, of losing your life and gaining it. filled with this kind of thing. But it happens often in O'Neill that there are parodies of his Catholic Christianity going on an awful lot. So you have to watch that. And he says, I belong with out past or future, within peace and unity and a wild joy within something greater than my own life, or the life of man, to life itself, to God, if you want to put it that way. This is alcoholic talkativeness, and they're not coming on about it. But there's a definition here of freedom which is belonging to that kind of rhythm and beauty. And then the other thing, other times in my life, when I was swimming far out, and then another kind of lying alone on the beach. So we've got three kinds of free experience here. Swimming far out at sea, being on this ship in this way, and on the South Sea Island, and where he said, I became the sun, the hot sand, the green seaweed anchored to rock and swaying in the tide, like a saint's vision of beatitude, like the veil of things as they seem drawn back by an unseen hand. And then, and for a second you see, and seeing the secret are the secret. For a second there is meaning, and the hand lets the veil fall, and you're alone, lost in the fog again. It's that movement there of going into the landscape, reaching beatitude, feeling that you got to the secret, and then coming out again. And that romantic stuff about the veil falling. This is an enormous backlog here of romanticism here, like the, you know, stripping away the veils is the way you do it. There is a secret meaning, and the mystic blindness, psychic blindness in booze or ecstatic relationships with moonlight gives you access to the universe, which makes you free. It's like it's the old elixir bit, isn't it? Coming on here, huh? Don't you think? This kind of thing. You see what it's that hunt for the single answer, the secret answer, which is, I don't think O'Neill ever lost, ever gave up.
Hello.
Hi,
thanks very much indeed.
But when you think what that means, when you think how stultifying that is, isn't it? I mean, it is so. I mean, again, it's the one thing we'll militate against no change. Again, it's very odd. It's as if somehow the romantic dream of finding the secret meaning, which it's all those myths like bringing back the youngest son, bringing back the secret stone. You know, that you're getting Grimm's fairy tales, all that stuff. That somehow there is. You know, there's a place in the universe at the end of the rainbow which has the pot of gold. You know, all those myths in human life, which are nearly all very bourgeois ones, actually. You can take them back to the 16th century most. There is some answer. But it's played back very much, isn't it, into the fact that he says then he grins wryly. It was a great mistake. My being born a man. I would have been more successful as a seagull or a fish. As it is, I will always be a stranger who never feels at home, who does not really want, and is not really wanted, and who never belonged, and must always be a little in love with death. It's the romantic stuff. And O'Neill is playing games here. But, you know, like so often O'Neill, he half believes it. You feel that, you know, you feel he's saying alcoholic talkativeness. And Edmund says this sardonically and so on, and they get slowly drunk, and the whole thing collapses into this whole boozery scene going on here. But you feel that there is here not only there's a double bourgeois justification. There's bourgeois romanticism and the family together. This is where the power of the drama lies. There are two profound things in the structure of the West, isn't there, that are being handled here. One is the family, and the other is that there is something you can unveil and get at which would change your life. Huh? That kind of thing. Shall we have one more section on Emily?
Yes.
I think what I propose to do, and that is to write. I have some notes which sketch out his whole career. So if you could see it as a whole, perhaps. I don't know whether that would be any use to you. Otherwise, we can look at another play. How do you feel? What would you like to do? I think one more we will do. Don't you think? I don't think we need to go.
I think you're just giving us the notes and not doing it.
I don't really mind. No, it's up to you because you're the ones that are working on the thing. What do you think? Shall we look at Iceman in detail, or look at The Touch of the Poet, or look at one of the early ones, The Hairy Ape, or what would you like? What do you think? What do you think will be necessary?
We've done
quite a bit on Ice. One way or another. Yeah.
The later
one,
the
better.
Yes.
How about Moon to Misbegotten?
Moon to Misbegotten, yeah. Okay.
Are those notes on the
I got these notes out. I typed out these notes in two lots, which cover practically every play that he did. Because, you know, I want to be able to see the thing, you know, the whole
thing.
Where is it going? You know, how does it begin? How does it end? What's happening?
As like,
to see the curve, as it were. Shall we do that next time? The time finishes off. And if we get halted in a play that you're particularly interested in, we can like be halted. What the hell does that really matter? Then after that we'll have a look at Wallace Stevens, I take it. Right. All right.
Well,
I suggest that what you look at, and I think you just plunge in and look at the simple thing. I really think you've got to get the Credences of Summer and the Esthetic Humor, the two long poems. I think you can study those. I mean, I think that all the business of all these little short poems and so on is interesting enough. But I think we might plunge right down into these long masterpieces, right? I think there's a point in taking it. So look at, if you will, read Credences of Summer and Esthetic Dumas. And have a look at those, and I suggest that we go into those in some detail. And then I think you'll find the shorter poems fit pretty well. Otherwise, I mean, if you're interested in sort of light relief after that, things like 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird and The Man with the Blue Guitar.
How
can
you leave The Man with the Blue Guitar?
Oh, I think it's kind of gay. I think we had a look at those towards the superinfection in there before. Did we not? No. Well, that's the other main thing. But I think The Credences of Summer and the Esthetic Dumas are rather more interesting, actually. I think, maybe I'm like, I never know if I've bought death with notes or supreme fiction. It may be because I've looked at it too often. I don't think Stan had really to very much attention. Yeah, you look puzzled.
No, I was wondering as I think about these things. About
I think I've got one somewhere, yeah.
Oh,
Oh, I'm
having
the wrong ear.
I think I have a vision that S came off tea.
I thought
I
was starting to
unbrick
it.
There we are.
Oh, there.
Oh,
that's
your
posthumous.
Yeah. There is a bit of it.
Oh, sorry.
They were selected, but tell them what the other people did in the panel.
Yeah, I think it's in the library.
I'll have a look at that.
I think it's in the library. There's always a problem.
So next time we'll have a final session on O'Neill, and then